For the fifth year now, some of the brightest minds in academia will join the ABC to build their communication skills and help share their insights on the big questions of our time. This year, the winners of RN's top five media residencies cover a broad spectrum of the humanities, from environmental history to Middle Eastern studies, religion and society, animation, and social research on older Australians. So we didn't get enough with that design discussion. We're going to get it now. Let's talk to two of our winners. Dr. Gareth Wern is a lecturer in biblical studies at the Australian Catholic University, and he joins me in the studio. Hello, Gareth. And Dr. Ruth Morgan is a science and environmental historian at Monash University, who joins me on the phone from Melbourne Airport. Congratulations to you both. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
And I'm also joined in the studio by RN's Jo Gelonesi, one of the organisers of the Top 5 Project. Hello, Jo.
Good morning, Geraldine.
Look, I think this is fabulous having humanities people discussing. I mean, for years we've interviewed scientists in this capacity. So is this, just before we move to our winners, is this a conscious policy, Jo, of sort of stretching the agenda?
Sure is. I mean, it does actually come out of the science residencies, which have been incredibly successful. We started those in 2015. And in fact, our next science residency is starting next week here in Ultimo. But yes, it comes out of that. And we've decided that, you know, scientists have had a lot to say, and we've been able to put them out there, connect them up with programs that can further their ideas and get their research to the public. Obviously, the humanities, social sciences and the arts have got a lot to contribute to the questions and issues of our day. And so, yes, it's an expansion.
As a mere arts graduate, I'm very happy to hear this. Now, Ruth, we could get a better understanding of what you do. It would be very helpful. I think you're an environmental and science historian. Now, I understand that's a growing field. What does the job involve?
Oh, well, thank you for having me. I think it's definitely a growing field because, of course, everywhere we turn now, we're talking about environmental challenges and also about how science understands these challenges. But of course, what environmental historians do and what historians of science do is look at how these understandings have emerged, how we've understood place over time and how that's changed. And then knowing that science often speaks for the environment, how those scientific understandings have emerged in particular historical contexts. So it's all looking at basically ideas in time, but focusing on the environment and science.
Are the scientists interested in this?
Yes, surprisingly. No, that's often the pleasure of talking to scientists themselves and then reflecting on how the science has changed and why and the kinds of pressures and I suppose what seemed urgent at different points in time and how those things have been influenced or resolved or not, as the case may be. I mean, of course, they're not just that's obviously the scientists that are still kicking around, but there's earlier periods as well. Yeah.
You have looked at how different societies have made sense of and then responded to environmental change throughout history. Do you think that helps advance this whole broader discussion?
Absolutely, because I think we do see these problems as very much scientific in nature and as if only we had more scientific knowledge about them. And I think what we've seen increasingly is that we do have a great deal of that knowledge. But why aren't we acting on that? Why is that slow? So it brings to mind that these are human and cultural problems. And I think that's what history and the humanities is helping us get a better grasp of just how entrenched certain ways of living are. And these are ways of life that are formed over generations. I mean, you know, the way that we live our everyday lives is something that we've just been developed and we're just so accustomed to those things. And so change is awfully difficult. And I think that's an important dimension to bring to these conversations about environmental challenges.
Do you think really you bring a different set of words to describing it? Because it would be very interesting if a different sensibility were to enter this debate, which often seems very stalled. I mean, is that tilting too much at a windmill that can't really deliver?
No, I think what the benefit of bringing these, I suppose, more arts or humanities fields to these sorts of conversations is that I think they seem more accessible to everyday people. I think when we classify some of these problems as scientific, it almost feels exclusive and, oh, well, I don't have the literacy to understand that. And I think that's a massive problem. Whereas if we can make people feel connected as individuals, as families, as somehow personally invested in them. And that's what stories do, whether they're historical or or literary, is that they really connect people to these issues. And I think that's a really important thing that we need to be doing.
You're about to board a plane to Kathmandu, I understand, where you'll be meeting the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the venerable IPCC. You're the only environmental historian on the panel, and you'll be focusing on water. This is very interesting. What's the IPCC trying to do in this area?
Well, I think their issue, again, is coming at this problem of having been around now for several decades. They were established in 1988. They're feeling pretty confident about the science they're putting forward, but why isn't that breaking through? And so a real emphasis in this particular round of meetings is on narrative, on how we convey information. And what the IPCC does is just bring together enormous amounts of information and make it digestible and try and synthesize. So to actually then make sense of all of that is where people, I'd like to think people like me, can help in that regard.
Mm. Now, Gareth, your research is based on the Dead Sea Scrolls, which is something that I haven't heard of for quite a while. It was furiously reported in the 90s, of course. Remind us what they are and why they're so important.
Sure. Well, the scrolls are a collection of nearly 1,000 documents from about 2,000 years ago, which reflect a really valuable, in fact, a unique insight into Jewish society and culture at a really important formative time within the Jewish tradition, but also just before the emergence of Christianity. And among other things, the scrolls contain our earliest examples of the texts that we've come to know as the Hebrew Bible, or in the Christian tradition, the Old Testament. And part of why they're so important is that they reflect, on the one hand, the real stability of the biblical text as it was taking shape, but at the same time, they reveal that the text of the Bible actually existed in multiple forms side by side. And so as this collection of scriptural texts took shape, it was reflected, I think, by real diversity and variety within the kind of social setting.
So that, are you saying, because at the time, you know, it ended as a, well, it became typically full of controversy, and I think that probably many listeners would say that they ended up being a bit confused about the Dead Sea Scrolls. So are you confident that you can break through that more, or maybe you're not even trying to do that?
I think we're at a really exciting time in Dead Sea Scrolls scholarship. In the early years of publication, shortly after the scrolls were discovered 70 years ago, the publication process was effectively mishandled, and control of the scrolls was limited to a few specialists. And it took a very long time for the kind of gridlock on that material to be opened up and for the scholarly community to have full access to what was found there. And a lot of the controversy which arose around the scrolls related to this kind of feeling that there may be some sort of a conspiracy or a cover-up, and that there was information being held back. In the 1990s, that was effectively opened up as a new editor came on board and coordinated the efforts of an international scholarly community to release this material to the scholarly community. And more recently, we've seen a very important project by Google in collaboration with the Israel Antiquities Authority to digitize the scrolls as part of a conservation project. But this means that all of that material is now freely available on Google in incredibly high-quality photographic reproductions.
Really?
Mm.
So what's that going to do?
Well, on the one hand, it's really important for scholars like me to have access to that material in the best possible quality and a range of different imaging techniques, which means that we can see stuff in the scrolls that we've just never seen before. It's possible to look beyond the grime and dirt which has accumulated over the years and to get a new sense of what these texts contain.
What might you find?
A lot of it is at this stage fairly kind of small details, but we're getting a more clear image of some of what the scrolls contain. But now that we've kind of moved into this new phase with the digitization, we're also able to take a step back and think about the collection more holistically. And so a lot of the work which is taking place at the moment is taking stock of where we're actually up to in our understanding of the scrolls.
So is it going to change biblical scholarship?
Yeah, I think in some sense, one of the really interesting things that we find in the scrolls is, as I said before, the diversity that exists within that biblical tradition. But we also get a sense of the context in which these early texts were circulating.
Yeah, but dare I say, what does that mean? You know, like, is it going to undermine the Bible, or is it actually going to augment it and say, well, look, there are other gospels or other epistles, rather?
I don't think we're going to find new biblical texts. In some sense, that term is a bit out of place when we're talking about the scrolls, because this concept of a Bible didn't really emerge until a bit later on. But what we find is a range of texts that have kind of an authoritative status within the communities that are using them. And what's very important at that early stage is sort of how these texts are being used, which is actually not dissimilar to the way that we use texts today. And also, as we step back and think about the variety that exists within that collection, so the different translations of these early biblical texts, there's some quite interesting analogies to the way we think about the Bible in the digital space today. So there are dozens of different Bible translations that exist online and in print, and all of them contain subtle little differences.
Mm. So can people go, just before I go back to Ruth, can people actually go to this, say, Israel Antiquities site and call this up?
Yeah, just it's called the Leon Levy Dead Sea Scrolls Digital Database. So a quick search on Google will bring it up.
And now back to you, Ruth. You're thinking of water and where you're going, because obviously an important part of all this, I think, is the application of this knowledge to people's lives. You know, in relation to, say, managing the Murray-Darling Basin, which has been somewhat in the news, how might your work as an environmental historian help with that sort of challenge?
Well, I think, it's a very complex problem, obviously, but I think what we can see is just the vast changes delicate yet valuable river system has undergone over the past, 100 years at least, since Federation, when the states were trying to carve up their piece of the river and how it would work. And I think we're seeing just how those transformations do take an enormous toll, and that we need to factor in that there's just not one group that needs to be served in these negotiations. And unfortunately, it's very difficult to serve all those interests. And yet we can see the contrast when we look perhaps further west to the Katatundi Lake Eyre situation, where we've seen those floods in Queensland from the beginning of the year make their way right down through the system, because it's not really impeded by dams and irrigation. We can just see that enormous contrast between these river systems, and you think, well, this is an example of how things might have turned out very differently for the Murray-Darling. And I think what history and what we're all trying to aim for here is transparency and for understanding of that complexity. And so I think bringing these different positions to life is really important.
So Joe Gelonesi, finally to you, how do you imagine that this is going to relate to people? You know, in effect, it's really rethinking, it seems to me, repositioning the role of the humanities in terms of the current debates.
Yeah, look, that's exactly right, Geraldine. And it will happen. It will happen naturally through the way our residents will work through the various programs and outlets of the ABC. They will be brought into a broader culture, a broader way of speaking to people. Even this interview this morning with Gareth, Gareth isn't saying, of course, is he's also interested in the modern religious debates that are on the table at the moment. Some of the biggest debates that are stuck. And of course, that kind of scholarship that he's doing can help untangle some of that, because it brings some real evidence to the table.
Well, look, congratulations to you all. We will listen with great interest. Dr. Ruth Morgan and Dr. Gareth Wern, two of the five recipients of this year's RN Media Studies Residencies in Humanities, thank you to you.
Thank you.
And a
thank
collaboration
you.
Between the ABC and the University of Sydney. And thank you also to Joe Gelonesi.
Thank you very much.